Mr. Buff, Real 3. We were talking about your training in and the receipt of foreign naval signals, and you mentioned the B-bar U-boat messages. I mean, was there anything else you were looking out for or that you'd hear when you got this? Oh, we're going to come to it, but in training, you know.
Oh, well, the thing that went along with this was the action that you undertook having received the B-bar message. And that was, but you then had to signal, sorry, you had to measure the angle from your ship from which the signal was being transmitted. And then that had to be transmitted by the ship through the wireless office to what we, quote, called Scarborough. Now, we were told that that was the place where they listened out for our signals, you see, but I let that from Milton Keynes myself.
Bletchley.
Yeah, I think so. But anyway, that was our routine. And having received this B-bar, we then either through a radio goniometer, we set the antenna around to detect from which angle this signal was coming, arrange this information to be transmitted by the signals officer to the wireless
room. Now, how did this how did it measure where they were?
If you have a series of, you have an aerial, which is in the form of a cross, so two vertical loops, and those two vertical loops are correspond to two coils, north, south, east, and west, and then you have a sensing coil that goes around to pick up which two coils are most sensitized, and that gives you the direction in which the signal's coming.
And that was, how did you spell that? The goniometer?
G-O-N-I-O-M-E-T-E-R.
And then you'd immediately communicate that to
But also, what you did, when you heard this B-bar, you had to transmit your code letter for the frequency that you were listening out on to a little local transmitter, a VHF transmitter, that was actuated by a foot pedal in the cabin, and that gave the members of the group the information that this signal is being transmitted, and they were to go over to the same frequency that you were listening on and pick up the signal and take a bearing themselves. Now, the length of time that this signal took to transmit was something like 15 seconds. Now, you imagine what that meant. You were taking this down, and you were doing your own bit, and you've got to stamp in this, and you've got to shout A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and that's all you said. You just gave that letter. And then you've got to report it to the bridge. So we did the reporting to the bridge after the message had finished, of course. So that was the routine. And I think it worked reasonably well, because there wasn't much else you could do, I don't think.
Yeah, so that was one thing you were learning, you know.
That's one thing we learned about the German menace of the U-boats in the North Atlantic.
And what other things were you learning there?
Well, I suppose we were learning the rudiments of the equipment we were going to be using.
And
Although we got onto the bull and it had the latest cathode ray tube set, which was completely different.
So what equipment were you taught in? We'll come back to what you had on the bull.
Well, remember I told you there were coils, and you worked this hand.
This is the goniometer.
Well, the machine that they gave us, which is the FH4X, was made by Plessy down here. And it was a cathode ray tube system which gave you an ellipse. As the signal was being transmitted, you got this ellipse period on your the screen. Now, you didn't know whether it was going to be from the upper part of the lips or from the lower part of the lips, because it was just a signal passing to an aerial, so you have to sense it. So quickly you had to do a sense, which was cut out two of the coils, so you're just left with two of them actually giving the signal. And then if you got a signal in from another ship, you had a job of changing four coils over in the set and putting another two in. You've got to find them as well. That was quite a routine.
And this was also called a goniometer, just a different way.
Well, it wasn't called a goniometer because, strictly speaking, it wasn't a goniometer. If you look at the term for goniometer, it's a device that you sense with a rotating centre point.
So what would this be called? Just a...
Well, I call it the S-set, yeah. Direction finding set.
Now, any other things you were taught there? Because that's just U-boat signals. Anything else you were taught?
No.
What about you mentioned Japanese codes?
Oh, yes, we were in Italian.
What were the marking points of Italian code?
I don't remember anything about Italian.
Japanese?
The Japanese. I think the problem was that the Japanese, about when did they surrender? I don't know if they surrendered about the time we were doing our training.
Italians?
The Italians. And the Japanese, of course, the signals are completely different. They use a different group of... they don't use the Arab alphabet. They use whatever, I don't know what you call it, Shintan, I suppose. But and all the groups are different, you see.
So that it was...
So you went back a stage to learn how to receive this stuff.
And was that not difficult to try and learn to receive a completely an angle? Because you didn't know any Japanese at all.
Or? Well, basically, what we were taught first were phonetic groups. They converted the Japanese into a phonetic group. So it might be ABA or CHA or. You find it comes up in Japanese names. It's a phonetic group, isn't it? And I think that is a translation of the Japanese into something that Europeans can understand. So I think they started that, and it didn't really matter because if you took it down, and that's a phonetic group, if a Japanese was reading it, you could convert it back to what the sign was, and he could understand that easily. So we never actually read Japanese itself, but we used a phonetic terms.
How much did you do of this work? That sounds like it'd be quite a job learning a whole new...
Well, another 3 months, you see, all told.
Anything else you were doing?
Well, the thing we also did, we had a special form for the Japanese to... We had to fill it out in a particular way.
Sorry, the form was pink, you said?
Pink. If you saw a pink form, you knew it was Japanese. And the first thing is there's a line across up here for something, and then everything else is written that way, vertically. So you took the message down vertically. You didn't take it horizontally, you did it vertically. But I think that if you learn Japanese, don't you read from the bottom right? I think that's okay actually, but I think it made it a bit easier from our point of view. Anyway, that was the biggest difference apart from the code, you know, the letters and the Morse code and this form of the recording the message.
Anything else you were learning while you were there?
Lunchtime visitors, the German strafers. We had one of those ones out there.
What do you remember of that?
He came over the parade with St. Bede's, a little school with a lawn at the back, which went out on the end of the cliff. Nearly hit the roof of the school, and then proceeded to just go over the cliff and into the sea. I think that was the only time that we saw anything like action there.
So basically, you were learning that the German, the U-boat, the German alphabet, the old Morse code alphabet. Mm-hmm. Learning what to do with the B bar codes, the submarine codes. There were other specialists. And then the Italian Morse code, which you don't remember, and the Japanese Morse code, which you, and that's about it, as far as you know. You didn't know anything about Ultra or Bletchley Park, otherwise. I mean, it's just subsequently you've guessed that messages were going there. But you didn't know.
We all thought that Scarborough was an unlikely spot for all these lanes that were taking all these messages down, all this listening equipment, etc. But it might well have been true. Could have been anywhere, couldn't it? I mean, it didn't seem to be anything unusual because a lot of the action is in the North Sea anyway, and Scarborough isn't that far from the North Atlantic.
And you were there for about May, for about 4 months? 5 months?
4 months, I think.
So through to September?
About that, yes.
And then, were you very much bound by secrecy? I mean, did they tell you that what you were doing was not to be talked about?
I didn't really talk about anything. Once you got my name, you never told them about anything you were going to do. And that was just an unmet
need. So it didn't change, it was just normal security. Yeah. Now, what happened? You left there in sort of around September. What happened next?
Well, I went to, in the Navy, you are related to a home division of Port. It used to be Chatham Portsmouth and Devonport.
Which was yours?
Mine was Chatham. Now no longer existed as a division. It just brought him from Devonport. I think.
So did you spend time at Chatham Barracks? Or?
Well, in the barracks, I spent a bit of time down there. And we had to go into the tunnels, during an air raid, which there always seemed to be an air raid at night.
What was that like?
A bit gruesome, it was. It's like being in there underground with everybody else in London in there as well. But we had some hammocks in there as well. But the telegraphists raising went up to the signal school, which was at Cookham, which is now where the prison is.
And what were you doing there?
Just hanging out. Well, we had a daily routine of instruction, which was our always thought a bit remarkable.
Were you being taught or were you teaching?
No, taught again.
And what were you learning there?
Well, just keeping speeds up and learning something that we didn't know, and then they would come up with some aspects. And we were a group, we weren't taught with the rest of the telegraphers. We had our special classroom. And they just go back over the goniometer problems, and they we didn't do any electrical servicing of the equipment.
Now you weren't there long, were you?
Well, I spent quite a time there, in fact, because I got a draft to Iceland, which didn't materialise. So you go through quite a routine if you've been drafted to another station or ship.
Why was the drafting cancelled? Do you know why?
Oh, I don't know. No. So it was a shore station, actually. in Reykjavik. Sorry. But I never got there. Well, I did go there because, but I didn't go to this senior school. I went to the beginning.
Later, yeah. So, what was the next step then?
I stayed in Chatham Sydney School until about last night.
So, not a lot of happening, just attending the Signal School. And
I think we were given domestic duties as well.
What were they?
Cleaning out the huts and your own hut, of course. The thing we did there was fire watching. We did that at Skegness as well. In the deep midwinter, we would stand on the top of those big halls and try to fire watch, looking out over the sea for the Germans to come.
And what was it like at Chatham?
Well, Chatham, at Signal School, it was. I think we were fire watching. We were protecting the men against the incursions of the one of these boys. You know what they call them, boys that go to prison. They're not prison, are they?
Borstal
boys. Borstal. It was Borstal. That's the name of the camp. That's the name of the prison. They're Borstal. And we did the watch outside the nurse's home, the men's home, not the nurse's home, the men's home.
What do you remember of that?
Nothing much. It was boring, absolutely boring.
Nothing ever happened?
Nothing ever happened, no. The rumors never came out, and the Boston boys never got out.
So the next thing then would be your posting. Tell me about that, how it happened.
Well, basically you get shit. Circulated. I don't quite know how you know you've got a chip, but perhaps somebody comes to you with a note and go to the regulating office, and of course the regulating office at Chatham is down in the barracks, so you'd have to go down into the barracks, and you knew that you were not coming back, so you took all your kit with you, so you might spend a night or two in the barracks, and then you'd have to go off and find wherever your ship was, if it was a ship. In this case, it wasn't really. The building was anchored in Belfast Bay. I don't think that's quite true. I think I'm not going to call it Belfast Bay, but anyway, it was anchored off Belfast. Our route was up to Stranraer by train, where we arrived at something like 4 o'clock in the morning, on the ferry to Larne. Down by train to the regulating authority in Belfast station, and then they took you out to the dock and onto a lighter, I suppose, out into the ship.
Now, what were your first impressions of the Bullen? Because they were an unusual ship for the Royal Navy, because they've been built in America. Could you tell me what you thought of the ship when you sort of first joined her, what your impressions of her were?
I think the thing that struck me the most was that all the officers were midshipmen. All the officers I ever met were midshipmen when I first went into the building. And in fact, the ship itself didn't give me any. I thought it looked rather sleek. It's got a bit of steam about it, but. As no armament or design, I've got no comparison. Except that I knew what an officer was, I knew what a midshipman was, and I knew what a warrant officer was, and a head officer, and that sort of thing. So, the skipper, the first lieutenant, that's the most senior officer under the captain. The navigator and the engineering officer were the only people, as far as I know, who were officers. And there must have been about four other officers who were at that time midshipmen. Mind you, I think very quickly they got a silver star. But that was the first thing that
that struck me about that ship. Heaven help us, we're running on midshipmen. I thought it was very well. I've got nothing to compare it with, but.
You hadn't served on the ship before, had you?
I hadn't served on the ship, no. But I thought it was very sleek, clean. We had bunks and a couple of them used to swim in the hammock. So we didn't have to swim in the hammocks in the bunk, you see. And we just took them all up and put them up to the deck end.
Could you describe the mess deck, you know, that you lived on?
On the bottom there, the bridge is somewhere near midway from the front back. And if you look at the structure of the bridge from the aft end, that's from the rear end, on the port side, that is the right-hand side of the ship as you're looking forward, there is a hatchway under the bridge structure which goes down into the bowels of the ship. Now, when you go down that gangway, through the hatch, down the gangway, you're presented with a mess deck which consists of two mess tables, one on either side of the passageway that goes right through to the front of the ship, and above them are bunks which are hitched up out of the way, three bunks hitched up out of the way, so you can sit down at the table, at the mess table, and then of course there will be forms on the side of the table alongside the gangway. And since the gangway coming down through the hatch would take up some feet from the bulkhead, you would also have bunks either side of you as you went down the gangway, the ladder.
And did your mess deck have a name, or was it a special mess deck?
No, it's just I don't think we have a name.
Who were you? Comms mess?
Communications
mess deck.
We had a petty officer telegraphist. Four coders, three signalmen, four signalmen, that including the leading signalmen. There'd be nine telegraphists plus three tells S, so that's 12. And the leading signalmen, 13 others. So all those were. I think the Pierre Tell, he had a bunk in the petty officer's mess.
And, how did you find? Was that comfortable in there?
Quite comfortable, yes. Fortunately, I had a bunk which was underneath the deckhead. That's the ceiling. The only inconvenience was that you had to climb up the mountain to get into it. But once you were there, I mean, you were virtually out of everybody's way. And any heat in the place was always on the applicant.
Were they dry ships,
yeah,
the mess deck?
Yes, quite dry. Yeah. I must admit, they seem to have made those ships quite well.
They were all. I mean, you hadn't been on a ship before, but were you aware of? They were welded, and the Royal Navy normally had the riveted ships. Were you aware of any of that?
Yes.
What did you think of? Did you worry that they weren't riveted?
But I've never been on a ship that went down before, you see. So unlike other people. I'd seen many ships in the docks, and I was always aware that they were riveted when they were put together, because you'd see a rivet. And when you see a pulling, you never see a rivet at all. It's all welded, you see. And indeed, after a while, when we were on convoy and we were hanging out at about 8 knots, we were rolling, the ship was rolling and pitching in the sea. And you could stand astride the central seam and see it move, and feel it move. And, you know, they were built fore and aft and put together.
That worry you?
Didn't mind me, no, I just thought it was a bit peculiar. And everybody said, well, it's a good thing for them to do that.
What about, they had, I think they may have been removed by the time you'd arrived. But did they still have the American fittings, like the water, iced water, yeah, and the ice cream maker and things like that? And
the only thing they kept was the laundry, where you could, if you wanted to, you could have the bedding washed. No, I don't think they took most of it out.
Was that mainly for bedding? What about your own uniform, smalls? How would you do that?
In the shower. I don't think I ever washed my uniform. I probably only had one. Well, you had three full uniforms. You had a best working overall group, and then whites. I don't ever remember having my uniform clean.
So what would you wash? Just underwear, socks?
Shirt, socks, underwear, handkerchief, and collar.
And that was done in the shower, not in a bucket?
No, do it in the shower, on that shirt, yeah. You'd have to do it in a bucket if you were in a barrow. But I suppose you could use a shower, but I don't think I would do it.
And what about the messing system, the food system? Because it originally had this some sort of cafeteria, Americanized system, and then they went onto a Royal Navy system. Do you remember the...
Yeah, we used to come down from... We were a bit fortunate because the galley was just after this main stack, and the entrance to our mess deck that I've just described was just forward of that. Without going up onto the upper deck, you went through a hatchway which went down underneath the funnel, you see. So the cooks were just a bit forward of us, you see. So we didn't have very far to go with, and you'd bring a tray or a pan out with the various things you'd have. If it was a roast, it was roast with potatoes, roast with it, and whatever, and the breakfast would come out.
And it would be, so it would be brought out in bulk and then divvied up into your plates. Yeah. You wouldn't get individual plates like the Americans had done. And who would prepare the food? Would it be done by the cook of the mess, or would it be done by the chef?
Well, you had to prepare the food, don't you? You had to cut the peel potatoes and things of that sort and take that up. But they would add any meat. And if you had vegetables, you'd have to do those sprouts or greens or something.
But you didn't have to provide sort of pies, worked up pies and things like that?
No, they did that.
And what did you think of the food?
I thought it was quite good, actually. The only time I didn't like it was when you put the seed first night and they always gave you pork. There weren't many people that ate pork that first night, you see.